The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, as he's traveling over in the United States. Well, the big news that from this morning that I'm sure you're aware of from last night is the burning of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, a really dramatic event that, well, around the world yesterday, people were watching all around the world in real time. As flames engulfed this cathedral, as the spire was wreathed in flames before falling. And this church is a big deal for France and for all of Europe. I've seen several different journalists on Twitter saying things like, this feels like the end of the world, or this feels like the apocalypse. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, he said, Notre Dame is our history, our literature, our imagination. The place of all our great events, our epidemics, our wars, our liberations, the epicenter of our lives. And this has been front page news all around the world. In France, it's just some of their front page headlines. La Croix, their headline is Heart in Ashes. La Parisienne, Our Lady of Tears. Libération, their headline is Notre Dame, or Our Tragedy. The Washington Post noted this morning that Notre Dame is the literal and figurative heart of Paris, the point from which all distances in the city are measured, and the seemingly eternal backdrop to life in the French capital. And there's a little plaque just outside the Notre Dame Cathedral, and that's basically the zero point for all of France's road systems, where that quote said, all of their distances are measured from. They're measured from Notre Dame Cathedral, the church that we saw and watched burn yesterday. The American Spectator, they wrote, first, the imagery of the beautiful sky, billowing smoke, shocked faces, and deep sadness feels like 9/11. It feels bigger than the loss of lives and two buildings, or in this case, a church. It feels like it's shifting history in real time. And I'll read a quote from them. I don't think everyone would share the drama that they put forward here. It's certainly a tragedy, but they paint it in very dramatic terms. But I think a lot of people do, and it's worth understanding the magnitude of the event in the eyes of a lot of people. This article says, it feels like we're witnessing the end of Christianity and Western civilization. Notre Dame is irreplaceable. No tower can be built in its stead. There will only be a time before and after Notre Dame. Perhaps this sentiment seems melodramatic. I don't think so, this journalist writes. Look at how the world has changed after 9/11. Look at the civil liberties we've lost. And they go through some of the ways the world has changed since that date. And then they write, how to convey Notre Dame's cultural impact. It's the heart of France. It's a religious and artistic monument. It's a place of worship. It's iconic. And it is gone. And it's drawn comment from politicians, not just from Macron, but even beyond France. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, she said that Notre Dame is a symbol of France and of our European culture. Our thoughts are with our French friends. So not just a symbol of France, but of all of Europe's culture. And it's not just an iconic building that draws around 12 to 13 million visitors each year. It's also houses a lot of France's most treasured pieces of artwork and religious relics. Barbara Drake Boehm, she's a senior curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Medieval Cloisters Bank and Branch in New York. She writes, it's not one relic, not one piece of glass. It's the totality. It's the very soul of Paris. But it's not just for the French people. For all humanity, it's one of the great monuments to the best of civilization. Now, one of these monuments, one of these artworks that are stored there is the crown of thorns. I think it's unlikely to be the actual crown of thorns put on Christ's head by the Roman soldiers when he was crucified, but many believe it is, and it is on public display at when the Catholics at the cathedral there celebrate Easter. So many would have been coming, planning on seeing that crown of thorns at this time of year, this object that they believe was set on Christ's head 2,000 years ago. I mean, that's a building and a location that has drawn a lot of people's attention. Now, regardless of what you might think of the artistic merits of the building, it also represents just a huge investment of human effort. Most of the building on Notre Dame Cathedral, it was done from 1160 to 1260 AD. And then they were still building. It was, in terms of the start to finish, it was closer to 200 years they were working on that, though most of the work was done during that initial 100-year period. 13,000 oak trees went into making the supporting beams for the roof, that roof that went up in flames. That's the equivalent of 52 acres of forest going into the roof that we saw burning. People have been worshipping at that site in Notre Dame in Paris for a long time. There was a temple to Juno or Jupiter in the Roman times on that site. There were several churches built after that. And then, as I said, 1160, they began working on that big church. And they estimate that around 1,000 people working on that cathedral. Just think about that. 1,000 people working for 100 years to build that building. Now, I don't know whether they were all, whether it was that many people for the whole of that century, but certainly a huge investment of people's labor. I mean, for people of that time, their best labor was devoted to these kind of cathedrals and to others like it. You had all of these skilled workmen working on this for so long. You had new building techniques basically invented to make these buildings, these cathedrals possible. At the time that the Notre Dame Cathedral was under construction, the largest enclosed space in Western Europe was the monastery at Cluny. By comparison, the largest enclosed space, I believe, in the world today is the Pentagon, or at least it was until relatively recently. I haven't checked whether that's been superseded. I guess we're always building newer and bigger buildings. But it gives you a sense of the focus that the Catholic Church and these structures had of just man's civilization. And this is something that Notre Dame Cathedral really reminds all of us of. For these buildings, when they were built, you could probably compare them to something like, say, the Apollo project, where the aspirations of a nation were really bound up in this one task. Except in this case, it took man, 10 years to go to the moon from when Kennedy gave his speech under that, whereas it took 100 years to build this cathedral. Laurent Ferry, curator of the pre-1800 collections in the Rare Divisions and Manuscript Collection at Cornell University, former curator at the French National Archives, he said, "The King of France wanted to build a magnificent cathedral to show that Paris was the political and economic capital of France. There was a strong alliance between church and state, and this idea that France was the first among the Christian realms, so the largest and most magnificent cathedral would have to be in Paris." That's what this building was about. Now, this time period of the Middle Ages, you see this play out all across Western Europe. There are not many really beautiful, ornate palaces from this period. There are plenty of castles, but they're just often very practical, utilitarian affairs, built for strength, built for defense, with some comfort. But in terms of these grand, beautiful structures that took 100 years to build, the impressive palaces of Europe came much later. That's all on cathedrals and monasteries at this time period. Only later, much later, do you have things like the Palace of Versailles being constructed. Because at this part of the Middle Ages, it was the Catholic Church that was at the heart of European society and where Europeans were devoting all of this energy. And the burning of Notre Dame Cathedral, it's a poignant reminder of the Catholic roots of European civilization. And I think the world, the whole world, is being reminded now in the wake of that tragedy of the Catholic roots of European civilization. You know, why is it that this cathedral is the heart of Paris, that all the roads in France are measured from that spot? When you're driving on the highway and it says 40 kilometers to Paris, it's to Notre Dame Cathedral. Why its burning has an emotional impact that spreads beyond Paris or France or even Europe to the point that you're having people in even the American Spectator writing in that quite dramatic way. The Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Nicholls, he's the most senior Catholic figure in England, he wrote, "The shock at the outbreak of this fire is spreading round the world. It is an iconic building visited by millions, but more importantly, it is the symbol of faith which is at the heart of Europe." And more specifically, you know, it's a symbol of a very specific faith that is at the heart of Europe, the Catholic Church. And you really see that being emphasized with Notre Dame and the response to this burning. Now, is this going to make Europeans more aware of this Catholic heritage? Make them appreciate the role that their church once played, in their whole civilization? Well, perhaps it will. It certainly seems a powerful symbol of Europe's Catholic heritage being under attack right now. And it could form a major part of Europe, or could form a powerful symbol in Europe, changing their response to that. Now, it does seem like this particular fire was accidental. There was renovation work going on, and somehow somebody managed to start the building on fire. But there's still a sense, part of the reason why it's generated so much resonance, emotional resonance around the world, is because there's already a sense of Western civilization, of European civilization, of Christian civilization being under attack. That's why you have people writing, "It feels like we're witnessing the end of Christianity and Western civilization." It's an emotional symbol of something people are already feeling. And could it play a part in people responding to that feeling? Now, this fire, it does come after an outbreak of church burnings and attacks in Europe over the last... Well, it's gradually been getting worse and worse. I was going to say over the last couple of years, couple of months, but even the year before, it was getting worse. The Catholic Herald had an article on this. This is writing towards the end of February, so we're going back a little now. And they wrote, "During the French Revolution's worst years, some of the most visible expressions of violence involved attacks on the church, which was perceived as a pillar of the Ancien Régime. Revolutionaries slaughtered numerous clergy and expelled thousands of others. They expropriated church-owned property and occasionally ransacked and burnt churches. It was hard not to recall these past events when reading about the recent spate of vandalism inflicted on Catholic churches throughout Europe over the past 2 weeks. The Observatoire de la Christianophobie reports that between February 3rd and 11th, 9 Catholic churches were subject to severe vandalism, ranging from the smashing of statues and stained glass windows to the overturning of tabernacles. One church in Yvelines, the Church of Saint-Nicolas de Huel, was vandalized 3 times in 7 days. This is really straining my secondary school French lessons here with trying to get some of these pronunciations. I apologize to our French and multilingual listeners for butchering some of these. But to continue with this article, it follows a series of similar attacks on Catholic churches throughout France in 2018. Vandalism isn't a new problem, but why have Catholic churches in France become a target in recent years? That's the question they ask. And since then, it's only gotten worse. There is the Church of Saint-Sulpice that was set on fire on March 17th. This is a church that was built in the 17th century. And I've seen pictures of the burning. It was a pretty big-sized fire. And police believe that was arson, deliberately burned, deliberately attacked. There was another church, Saint-Alain Cathedral. So, well, not just a church, a cathedral in Laval. That's in south-central France. There, the altar cloth was burnt. There were statues of saints and crosses that were smashed. The mayor there, he said, he was so angry, he gave a public statement. He said, "God will forgive, not me." The Tablet, a Catholic magazine, they've charted 47 attacks on churches and religious sites just since February. The Observatory of Intolerance and Discrimination Against Christians in Europe, based in Vienna, they've reported a 25% increase in attacks on Catholic churches in the first 2 months of 2019 compared to the same time period in 2018. More recently, you had 12 attacks take place within a week. You saw that one at the start of February. There were 7 attacks in a week, 12 attacks in a week. The Gatestone Institute had an article on this published the day before Notre Dame caught fire. And they talked about how in Germany, 4 separate churches were vandalized or torched in March. Now, some of these attacks are from secular groups, from radical left-wing groups. But sometimes church doors have had Allahu Akbar written and graffitied on them. And it's been radical Muslims behind this attack. So you can see why more and more in Europe are feeling like their civilization is under attack. Now, this is also coming from radical Islam. And this is a threat that Europe is... The threat from radical Islam is one that they're gradually waking up to. And it's one the Catholic Church is increasingly calling on Europe to confront. We have an article up on our website right now titled Catholic Bishop, If Europe Disappears, Islam Will Invade the World. And, well, this article states, a high-ranking bishop in the Catholic Church has made it his mission to open Europe's eyes to the danger posed by Muslim migrants. This is Cardinal Robert Sarah. He's the Vatican's prefect for the Congregation of Divine Worship and Discipline of the Sacraments. So, senior figure within the Catholic Church. Now, the Pope has been telling everybody that they need to let more migrants in, but this senior cardinal has been coming out with a very different message. He said, as a bishop, it is my duty to warn the West. He condemned liberal Catholics for encouraging Catholics to welcome and encourage migration. He says that it's a false exegesis or a false teaching, a false interpretation of the Bible to use the word of God to promote migration. God never wanted these rifts. And he says that the migrant crisis is harmful to Europe and harmful to the migrants. He wrote that all migrants who arrive in Europe are penniless, without work, without dignity. The church cannot cooperate with this new form of slavery that has become mass migration. He made all of these comments. It was in an interview with a French journalist, Nicolas Dia, that he says, as during the fall of Rome, elites are only concerned to increase the luxury of their daily life, and the people are being anesthetized by ever more vulgar entertainment. The barbarians are already inside the city. Now, that's what he's warning about when he's talking about the migrant crisis. The barbarians are already inside the city. He warned that, well, he pointed as well, not just to migrants in general, but to Muslim migrants. He said that if the West continues in this fatal way, there is a great risk due to a lack of birth, it will disappear. And then he said that if that happens, well, that was in the title, Islam Will Invade the World. And then he said that in order to deal with the threat posed by Islamism, Europe must rediscover its Christian roots and its identity. A West that denies its faith, its history, its roots, and its identity is destined for contempt, for death, and disappearance. And now, burning on all of our TV screens is a powerful reminder of Europe's Christian roots, how intertwined European culture and the Catholic Church are. You know, you want to cement your city, Paris, as the capital of France, build a massive cathedral. So you know, that's that powerful symbolism of Christianity and European culture under attack, under siege, is out there. And at the same time, you know, we're seeing more people speak up, in the people like Cardinal Sirah, about Europe coming under attack from secularism, from Islam, from Catholicism being under attack from these forces. Are we going to see some kind of a waking up? Well, the Bible says we are. Now, we draw a lot of attention to Europe returning to its heritage, in the words of Cardinal Sirah, to rediscovering its Christian roots and identity. And we draw attention to those quotes and we warn about it. We warn about the great danger of Europe returning to its roots. But what really is Europe's heritage? What are the roots that it's talking about? Well, we'll take a quick break, and we'll look at that as we come back in the second half.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The Holy Roman Empire has made pivotal and defining contributions to Western civilization. But its many reincarnations have also come with painful and catastrophic consequences. European leaders aim to unite the fractured continent of Europe by reviving the legacy of this extraordinary church-state combine. One of the great lessons of this empire is that it always comes back. There is always another resurrection. To understand much more on this vital subject, call now and request our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. The Holy Roman Empire is not just a relic of history. It is about to play a central role in world events. Coming to understand about the nature and character of this powerful institution tells you as much about the future as it does about the past. As part of this free offer, also request Herbert Armstrong's classic work, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? Both booklets are available at no cost or obligation to you. In addition to the free book, you may also request a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. The Trumpet examines world events under the clear light of Bible prophecy. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
There is going to be a resurrection of that old Roman Empire. Not very many people believe it, because people have gotten completely beyond really believing that the Bible means what it says. You're going to have to live and see it, and you're going to have to know that God was speaking when he said this thing is coming.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. I understand they've been having some network problems again at our offices in Edmond, Oklahoma, at our headquarters. So you may have missed some of the beginning of the show. If you have, you'd still be able to go up and listen to that online if you want to get some context for what on earth I've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. That's at kpcg.fm, and you can listen to all of our podcasts, all of the many different shows that we have here on KPCG. Well, we began by talking about Notre Dame Cathedral and burning down yesterday, and just how that's a powerful reminder of how fundamental the Catholic Church is to Europe's heritage, to Europe's culture, to Europe's civilization. This is the building that's the center of France, where the center of Paris, where all even the road measurements come from. And we concluded the second half talking about how Europe is returning to its roots, about how this European civilization is increasingly under attack, and there are more and more people realizing that. We talked about the spate of church burnings. We talked about some comments from Cardinal Sirard, a high-ranking Catholic cardinal, saying, well, you know, the West needs to wake up. The West needs to stand up to Islam. And this is a warning we give regularly on the Trumpet Daily radio show, that Europe is going to return to those roots. But what I want to do on this half is look at, well, what are those roots? Because there are a lot of different people out there who would say, great. You know, if Europe wakes up to the threat of radical Islam, if Europe returns to its culture and civilization that built buildings like Notre Dame Cathedral, that's an excellent thing for this world. This was a continent of high culture and arts and science and progress. And so, yes, if Europe gets more self-confident and takes on a stronger role in the world, That's exactly what we need. That's the kind of thinking that former President Barack Obama displayed when he was visiting Germany just a few weeks ago. Mr. Flurry played this clip shortly after that visit.
Europe in 2019, in some ways, has achieved the pinnacle of human well-being.
Europe, this is the pinnacle of civilization. There's been this long progress, this process of progress in Europe that has driven the world forwards. And so you see people saying, well, yes, we need a European army, a European superstate. We need to have Europe be confident in its roots, in its Christian heritage, in its Catholic roots. And you see European leaders talking and writing about these things. You see French President Emmanuel Macron having an article that went out in newspapers in all 28 EU member states calling for more Europe. Never since World War II has Europe been as essential, he wrote, yet never has Europe been in so much danger. Now, if Europe was to successfully combine itself, it would have the world's second largest economy, the world's second largest military budget. And so people do look at that and say, well, yeah, would that not be a good thing? Now, this view of Europe as the pinnacle of civilization, it kind of comes from this very rosy picture of Europe's past. The Greeks invented democracy, the Romans invented the rule of law, the Roman Empire ushered in peace and prosperity, and life was good until Rome fell. Then we reached the Dark Ages, a time of violence and barbarity where human progress stopped. And then the world was only illuminated for brief periods where European rulers attempted to resurrect the Roman Empire. And you had kings working side by side with the Catholic Church. French king and French pope, both there present as work on the Notre Dame Cathedral began. And then came the Enlightenment, this kind of story of world history goes, and free thinkers across Europe invented freedom as we know it, and Britain developed those ideas, America put them into practice with a radical new government. And so, yeah, based on that kind of view of the past, then it does seem obvious, yes, this Europe will be a force for good in the world. Yes, we need Europe to embrace this heritage. But that view of history is horribly, horribly incomplete. We look at things like Notre Dame Cathedral and all of this and some of this art and culture, and then completely overlook everything else associated with that, everything else that was going on at the time. We look only at those cultural achievements and really overlook the main character of this European empire at the time. Let's just take one incident for example. So Notre Dame Cathedral was being built from 1160 to 1260, this massive architectural project that is revered around the world. While that was going on, you had, and that was being built by the Catholic Church and the French Empire, the French nation, working hand in hand. Like I said, both the king and the pope were there when it was being built, the king supporting it, the local bishop doing a lot of work on the design. Well, let's look at what else the Catholic Church and France were working hand in hand with at exactly the same time. 1208. So during the time that cathedral was being built, you had the Albigensian Crusade in the south of France, where there was an outbreak of a religion the Catholic Church did not agree with. And so knights who went and fought and killed these Christians were given a free pass from the Pope through the purgatory. It's this crusade that the very famous remark from the Pope comes from, where it doesn't matter to sort through the innocent from the guilty or the heretics from the true Catholics. Kill them all, the Pope said. God will know his own. Whole cities were massacred. One soldier boasted to the Pope they'd killed 15,000 in taking one city. He said that they'd showed no mercy, neither to order, nor to age, nor to sex. This was a license for soldiers to rape, pillage, and burn, and while the Pope told them they were doing God's work. Paul Johnson, he writes about this in The History of Christianity, and they wrote that in punishing, he called them thought crimes. The church violated town charters, written and customary laws, basically or virtually every aspect of established jurisprudence. The object was quite simply to produce convictions at any cost. So they right when this, what is viewed by many as a beacon of civilization, was going up, the same people that were building it, or the same organizations that were behind it, were killing tens of thousands of people in the name of religion. So let's take a fuller look at European roots, a look in history, but a look grounded in the Bible as well. Now, if you go back to the roots of European history, and the Bible and just about all European thinkers will send you to exactly the same place, Rome. And this was the civilization that many in Europe looked back to, that in the ensuing centuries they wanted to resurrect and rebuild. And Rome, sure, has a lot of magnificent cultural achievements. It's an empire that lasted for a really staggering amount of time. Very few empires were able to be as long-lived as them. But at the same time, you know, and they had some just really interesting, really admirable individuals, Cato, Cicero, some of these thinkers who we still read and study today. I think Cicero's anti-Catilinarian speeches are some of the most imitated and studied speeches in the history of the world. And we tend to look on Rome very positively. But we overlook a darkness in Rome's heart. You know, this was a society where humans watched other humans fight to the death as entertainment, where a baby didn't count as human until it was accepted by his father. You know, if rejected, the parents would expose him, which means leaving the baby to die of exposure, usually in a rubbish dump. And we have letters from between parents, just casually saying things like, well, if the child is a boy, you know, great, accept him. If he's a she's a girl, expose her. And then move on to a shopping list or something like that. Now, if the baby was lucky, he'd be rescued by slave traders, eager to profit from the Republic's insatiable demand for slaves. The number of slaves in Italy by the first century BC was estimated to be around 20 to 40% of the population. You're talking about 1.5 million slaves. In later times, the empire was supported by a workforce of an estimated 5 million slaves. This was something fundamental to the Roman economy. And it wasn't just, I guess we tend to have this picture of household slaves, say, from Roman times. But for a lot of people, it was working in chain gangs in the fields and just being discarded and left to die when you're no longer capable of that kind of manual labor. The Roman Empire, its foundation of its power was really based on brutality. It became a superpower in the second century just really based on two separate shocking acts of brutality. Now, Carthage has been Rome's greatest rival for control of the Mediterranean. They fought a series of wars. In 216 BC, the Carthaginians under Hannibal defeated the Romans at the Battle of Cannae, one of the most famous battles in the history of the world. Rome barely managed to survive that war, and it eventually beat Carthage. But by 146 BC, this was old history. That happened, you know, 50 years ago or more. Carthage was no longer a threat. They'd been defeated for a long time. But Rome decided that Carthage was to be destroyed. And here's a clip from a documentary talking about that destruction.
Delenda est Carthago. Carthage must be destroyed. Three short words barked from the mouth of a superpower. Rome's death sentence on one of the most dazzling empires of the ancient world. It was a fine spring morning when Armageddon began. The city of Carthage, in what is now Tunisia, had been under fire for 3 years when the Roman army broke through the gates of the city. From that moment on, innocent people had just weeks to live. death had come to Carthage, and no one would be spared. The orders were precise. Leave not one building standing, not one person alive. What followed was a holocaust. The Roman troops would tear down Carthage's Senate House, burn its library, and defile its sacred shrines. A year's vicious toil would reduce the city to dust. In annihilating Carthage, 150 years before Christ, the Romans made a whole civilization disappear. Rome wanted Carthage completely and permanently erased.
But perhaps the most astonishing thing about the destruction of Carthage that you heard about there is that wasn't the only city erased that year. Or at least that, I think it was, sorry, about 3 years later, I'm getting the different siege dates confused, but that period, it was the same year. Corinth was the richest city in Greece at the time. They were famous all across the Mediterranean for their art, for their culture. And then 146, so 3 years after Carthage, Rome wiped Corinth out as well. Every man killed. They kept the women alive there. The city was famous for its seedier entertainments. So they enslaved the women, they enslaved the children. The idea of Corinthian bronze became common. This idea that as the city burnt, all of its gold and its silver and its bronze all melted together in and flowed in the streets. And this became the foundational doctrine of Roman power, punishment through citywide destruction. You know, if the Romans had nuclear weapons, they would have used them. It would have just simply been a more efficient way of achieving what they did anyway to Carthage. Tom Holland wrote in his book, Rubicon, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Roman Empire, that the obliteration of not one but two of the greatest cities of the Mediterranean was a stunning outrage. He wrote, even the Romans themselves felt a little queasy. No longer could it be pretended they were conquering the world in self-defense. It went on, cowed and obsequious, states far beyond the shores of Greece also redoubled their efforts to second-guess the Republic's will. Throughout the monarchies of the East, assorted royal poodles would jump whenever the Romans snapped their fingers, perfectly aware that even a hint of independence might result in the hamstringing of their war elephants, or the sudden promotion of rivals to their thrones. And all of this was even before Rome became an empire. Some of the most detailed accounts of the brutality of Rome's expansion come from Julius Caesar's conquest of Gaul a century later. He expanded the borders of Rome. He brought the territory that's now France into the Roman Empire. But I think this is even based on his own writings. Around 1 million Gauls were killed and another 1 million taken as slaves in the process. When anyone defied or upset Rome, they were met with crushing force. Jumping forwards again in time again, when the Jews rebelled, for example, in AD 70. The Romans massacred tens of thousands of them. Eventually, they even wiped the names of Jerusalem and Judah off the map, or at least tried to. Josephus put the death toll at 1 million, with another basically 100,000 being carried off as slaves. And this is the reality behind Pax Romana, this Roman peace. I mean, there was a phenomenon called Pax Romana. There was this time of peace under Rome, but it was enforced by this brutality. And all the ensuing attempts to resurrect the Roman Empire, well, they all embraced this same heritage. The Western Roman Empire fell in the 5th century. In the East, it lingered in the form of the Byzantine Empire, even though this went into decline. But in AD 527, this received a new breath of life under the Emperor Justinian. Now, under Justinian, we start to see an important change even in the character of this reoccurring power in Europe. You know, generally, the Roman Empire cared little for the religion of its subjects. They had the periodic persecutions against Jews and Christians, but on the whole, it didn't really matter too much. The Emperor Constantine had converted to Catholicism 200 years earlier, and he had begun Rome on the path to a theocratic state. But under Justinian, the Roman Empire fully embraced the state religion and the persecution of dissenters. So Justinian's law stated that Christians who didn't conform to the Catholic Church must be driven outside the walls of the city with relentless violence. Non-Catholic places of worship were eradicated all the way out into North Africa. The Encyclopedia Britannica wrote, as no preceding sovereign had been so much interested in church affairs, so none seems to have shown so much activity as a persecutor both of pagans and of heretics. And so religion and religious conquest even now became part of the empire's goals. Tom Holland, he wrote, this is in his book, The Shadow of the Sword. He wrote, for the first time in Roman history, the conversion of pagan kings became enshrined as a priority of state. The church, of course, had been ambitious to plant the cross in the furthest most reaches of the world. That the Roman state had a duty to contribute to this mission, however, was a more radical presumption. And so as part of this, Justinian reconquered Rome, restoring the empire in the West. But he couldn't hold on to it for long, and soon he lost that. The Byzantine Empire went back into their long decline. And the next to revive this Roman Empire was Charlemagne, who you hear a fair bit about on this program. He ascended to the Frankish throne in AD 768, and he followed the same pattern of the Roman Empire, but with that same pattern that Justinian established with that relationship with the Catholic Church. The Pope legitimized his rule by preaching that he was the rightful king of the Franks, and later the Holy Roman Empire. In return, Charlemagne supported the Pope militarily. There was a biographer, his biographer and loyal servant, Einhard. He wrote, "Never was there a war more prolonged or crueler than this, nor one that required greater efforts on the part of the Frankish people." This was his longest war with the Saxons. Tom Holland, this time it's in his book Millennium, he wrote, "Warfare had long been the activity of choice among the Franks. Leaders who failed to provide their followers with the spoils of pillage rarely endured for long. No sooner had winter thawed into spring than the Frankish people dusted down their spears and were prepared to follow their king out on campaign. Charlemagne, whose hunt for booty was insatiable, had inherited the full appetites of a primordial line of warrior chiefs." And so he fought in the name of religion. After one rebellion, he executed thousands of prisoners, entire tribes were forcibly relocated, and even some of his own advisors questioned the degree of bloodshed he was inflicting. Holland describes how Charlemagne saw himself as a new David at the head of a new chosen people called by God. He wrote that it was the perfect conscientiousness of this that Charlemagne made the wastes of Saxony to flow with pagan blood, that he spread even among the barbarous Slavs who swarmed on the outer reaches of the world awful rumors of the wrath and terror of his name, that he returned every autumn from his campaigns with lumbering wagon trains of booty, spoils with which to strengthen the Christian order throughout his vast domains. He imposed Catholicism on all he could reach, refusing to be baptized, carried the death penalty, following the old pagan religions, the same death penalty, holding unauthorized religious meetings, the death penalty, eating meat during Lent, the death penalty. Holland wrote, "Not since the age of the Caesars had atrocities been committed on quite so imperious a scale, and never before with the goal of imposing the love of Christ." So it's a resurrection of what the Caesars did, but with the addition now of this religious element. Now, that empire fell apart soon after Charlemagne died, but in 955, this Roman Empire was again resurrected. This time, it was the Saxons themselves, now thoroughly converted to Catholicism, who provided the emperor, Otto the Great. Again, going back to Tom Holland, he wrote, "It was taken for granted that warfare must be a Christian's ultimate duty in Otto's empire." And it was the same. This was an empire that showed leniency to Catholic enemies, but pagan enemies were to be massacred as much as possible. No prisoners. He would even, in those days it was common to take high-ranking prisoners high-ranking nobles prisoner and ransom them. Otto, if he was fighting a pagan enemy, would take the high-ranking nobles captive and kill them. He wouldn't even ransom them. It was during the reign of Otto's descendants that the Catholic Church launched the Crusades, a series of bloody wars designed to retake the Holy Land, where millions died. And these are probably the best known examples of Catholic bloodshed, but they're just part of a much longer, larger, bloodier pattern. Now, after Otto's empire declined, you had the Habsburg dynasty revive the Holy Roman Empire. And under the Habsburgs, the Holy Roman Empire reached its largest territorial extent. It was under Philip of Spain, where Spain conquered most of the New World. And then the Spanish branch of the Habsburgs, it was eventually brought in under Charles V, with the Austrian Habsburgs into just this colossal empire. And the Catholic Church poured into these newly conquered territories. There were reports of different religions going in and baptizing 5 million people. Newly introduced diseases wiped out huge numbers of those that they conquered. But then the Spanish and the Portuguese also committed massive massacres in expanding their empires. And they even wrote about them themselves. One account, a contemporary account, describes people pillaging like beasts, each man utterly possessed by greed. Now, of course, the Aztecs don't really make a very sympathetic victim. The Spanish Empire wiping out a civilization built on slavery and human sacrifice. But the point is, this pattern of European butchery continued. And then meanwhile, there's plenty more of this butchery back home. The Protestant Reformation had begun, and the Habsburgs took the lead in combating it. The empire repeatedly drove out Protestants and Jews and Muslims from Spain. Wars of religion, again, repeatedly broke out. The estimates put the persecutions and wars of religion, the death toll from those, at 50 million people. Napoleon, he was the next to resurrect the Roman Empire. His armies march under standards depicting Roman eagles. He conspicuously modeled himself after Julius Caesar. And he initially opposed the Catholic Church, but then he cut a deal with it. He brought Catholicism back to secular post-revolution France, restored many of its privileges. He had received the Church's support. He had the Pope come and play a role in crowning him at his coronation ceremony in Notre Dame Cathedral. And the Catholic Church, from that point on, well, from the point that he signed his concordat with them, supported Napoleon. And in his bid to take over Europe, Napoleon launched war after war. Credible estimates of the death toll put that around 5 million. And he was callous about the death, even of his own countrymen. After the Battle of Austerlitz, one of his generals lamented the number of French dead. And Napoleon replied, "Ah, the women of Paris can replace those men in one night." In 1813, the Austrian foreign minister, Clemens von Metternich, he warned Napoleon, the human cost of continuing to fight. But Napoleon said he would gladly sacrifice 1 million Frenchmen for his empire. Now, his empire famously ended, or his reign, at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. The next attempt of establishing a massive European empire needs little explanation. It was Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini modeling their rule after the Roman Empire. Hitler even copying his salutes from the Roman Empire, Mussolini using the eagle, both of them having the same kind of standards, Hitler revering Charlemagne. And the death toll from that was some 60 million. Now, it's easy to look at World War II as an aberration in European history, but in truth, it was a continuation of 2,000 years of European history. This is the European roots. This is the true roots of Europe. This is why we get very worried when we hear people say, Europe needs to get back to its heritage. Well, this really is the heritage that they're talking about. And like I said, the Bible has a lot to say about this heritage as well. It has some vivid description of the history that we've just covered that match perfectly with those events. In the book of Daniel, God gives an overview of thousands of years of world history. And described clearly in that book are men like Alexander the Great, with prophecies so clear and accurate, obviously accurate, that critics insist they have to be forgeries, that they must have been written after the event. Now, you can prove that this isn't the case, but the book also describes the empire that followed Alexander. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7, I'll just read a bit about it from the New Living Translation, but it describes a beast that is terrifying, dreadful, and very strong. It devoured and crushed its victims with huge iron teeth and trampled their remains beneath its feet. And you can look at this Daniel chapter 7 tells you that these by beasts it's referring to different empires. And so this is referring to an empire terrifying, dreadful, and very strong. Now, it's an excellent description of the power that defeated Carthage and then returned 50 years later to grind its last remains into dust. That's an empire that crushes its victims with huge iron teeth and then tramples their remains beneath its feet, as Daniel 7 and verse 7 said. That's exactly what Rome did. Verse 23 says that this beast will devour the whole world, trampling and crushing everything in its path. And that's exactly what the Roman Empire did with all of the known world at that time. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had some important comments on this passage in his book, Daniel Unlocks Revelation. And he writes, "These are dreadful beasts that conquer and enslave entire nations. It's what these beasts do." However, he continued that Britain and America like to think of them as harmless wild animals. They fear to face the extremely unpleasant truth. And that's exactly right. Daniel chapter 7, it really emphasizes the strength and destructiveness of this Roman Empire. Mr. Flurry writes, "The Roman Empire is the most vicious beast this world has ever known. It is the greatest monster human beings have ever seen." Now, Daniel 7 describes this beast having 10 horns, which it says in verse 24 are 10 kings or kingdoms that shall arise out of this beast. So this beast ruled the world for a time as the Roman Empire, but then there were 10 more resurrections of that Roman Empire that followed. This verse goes in to describe a little horn, which comes up after the first three. And it rises after them. It says that it shall be diverse from the first, subdue three kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. Now, this little horn, it refers to the Catholic Church, this great false church. The first three horns are the three barbarian resurrections of Rome, where these barbarian kingdoms attempted to resurrect the Roman Empire. And they were plucked up in AD 554 by Justinian's Byzantine Empire. And that established that relationship with the Catholic Church. And from then on out, this little horn, this Catholic Church, changed times and laws, influenced the subsequent empires, attacked the saints of the Most High, attacked other Christian churches, just did everything that it could to attacked the true Christian church, attacked other Christian groups, and did everything that it could to cement itself as the only religion. This is the crucial overview of European history. Now, Mr. Flurry, in that book, he talks about, he writes, "The only things Americans seem to think of when it comes to Europe," this is Mr. Flurry's words, is someone yodeling in the Alps. "They have no idea what the Holy Roman Empire is about or what that crown is about. They don't know anything about this deadly beast. You can travel over Central Europe and still see some of the opulence of the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs were the sword of the Catholic Church throughout the Middle Ages. They did their killing while supporting artists like Mozart, Bach, and Schubert. They were very sophisticated as they slaughtered people." And you see the same kind of thing with Notre Dame the Cathedral, this building widely regarded as a pinnacle of human achievement and civilization. But it's the product of the same civilization and even the same leaders that were out massacring people that they disagreed with over religion, killing thousands and thousands and thousands of them, probably tens of thousands. This history sounds a huge warning about Europe's modern efforts to integrate. Yes, it's the home of some of humanity's greatest achievements, but it's also the home of humanity's worst atrocities. And this is just, you know, this isn't, we've not just looked at a few exceptions. This is a pattern of history over 2,000 years. This is what it means of Europe returning to its roots. The Bible gives us a powerful warning about the character of this European empire that has risen up repeatedly and is about to rise up one more time. But the Bible also adds great hope to that warning that we can get from history. You know, the God who described in the 500 BC, 2,500 years of human history so accurately, you know, that's what's revealed as well in these, and even more importantly, in these prophecies in Daniel. And we're living now in the time of this final horn, the last king of the Holy Roman Empire, as they return to their roots one more time. Daniel chapter 7 shows us the next major event in human history is the return of Jesus Christ. And Daniel 7, it also details the reason God allows this church-state empire to repeatedly inflict this mass bloodshed. You know, the focus isn't even on this in this chapter, isn't on this terrible beast, but what happens when it is gone. It says the thrones of all of these different beast powers are cast down in their place, and that on one like the Son of Man receives dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples and nations and languages should serve him. You know, this is what it's leading for. Mr. Flory writes, these events were designed to crush all hope man has in himself and turn him to hope in God. That's what this empire in Europe is all about. That's where it ultimately is leading. Now, you can read more about this history in our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. And then Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory has a book, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, that will take you, just dig out some fantastic depth from these prophecies. That is about all that we've got time for. We'll have another exciting lineup of guest hosts continuing on this week. So please do stick around here at KPCG. That's 101.3 on the FM dial.